Chapter 106, in which a charade is acted which may or may not puzzle the reader. After Becky's appearance at my Lord Stang's private and select parties, the claims of that estimable woman as regards fashion were settled, and some of the very greatest and tallest doors in the metropolis were speedily opened to her door, so great and tall that the beloved reader and writer hereof may hope in vain to enter at them. Dear brethren, let us tremble before those august portals. I fancy them guarded by grooms of the chamber with flaming silver forks with which they prong all those who have not the right of the entree. They say the honest newspaper fellow who sits in the hall and takes down the names of the great ones who are admitted to the feasts dies after a little time. He can't survive the glare of fashion long. It scorches him up, as the presence of Jupiter in full dress wasted that poor imprudent semel, a giddy moth of a creature who ruined herself by venturing out of her natural atmosphere. Her myth ought to be taken to heart amongst the Tabernians, the Bulgravians her story, and perhaps Becky's too. Ah, ladies, ask the Reverend Mr. Thurifer if Bulgravia is not a sounding brass and Tabernia a tinkling cymbal. These are vanities. Even these will pass away, and some day or other, but it will be after our time, thank goodness. Hyde Park Gardens will be no better known than the celebrated horticultural outskirts of Babylon, and Belgrave Square will be as desolate as Baker Street, or Tadmor in the wilderness. Ladies, are you aware that the great Pitt lived in Baker Street? What would not your grandmothers have given to be asked to Lady Hester's parties in that now decayed mansion? I have dined in at Moi Kuai Vaus Peril. I peopled the chamber with ghosts of the mighty dead. As we sat soberly drinking claret there with men of today, the spirits of the departed came in and took their places round the darksome board. The pilot who weathered the storm tossed off great bumpers of spiritual port. The shade of Dundas did not leave the ghost of a heeltop. Addington sat bowing and smirking in a ghastly manner, and would not be behindhand, when the noiseless bottle went round. Scott, from under bushy eyebrows, winked at the apparition of a B-swing. Wilberforce's eyes went up to the ceiling, so that he did not seem to know how his glass went up full to his mouth, and came down empty, up to the ceiling which was above us only yesterday, and which the great of the past days have all looked at. They let the house as a furnished lodging now. Yes, Lady Hester once lived in Baker Street, and lies asleep in the wilderness. Eothen saw her there not in Baker Street, but in the other solitude. It is all vanity to be sure, but who will not own to liking a little of it? I should like to know what well-constituted mind, merely because it is transitory, dislikes roast beef. That is a vanity, but may every man who reads this have a wholesome portion of it through life, I beg. I, though my readers were 500,000. Sit down, gentlemen, and fall to, with a good hearty appetite. The fat, the lean, the gravy, the horseradish as you like it, don't spare it. Another glass of wine, Jones, my boy, a little bit of the Sunday side. Yes, let us eat our fill of the vain thing, and be thankful therefor. And let us make the best of Becky's aristocratic pleasures likewise, for these two, like all other mortal delights, were but transitory. The upshot of her visit to Lord Stang was that His Highness the Prince of Peterwaradin took occasion to renew his acquaintance with Colonel Crawley when they met on the next day at the club, and to compliment Mrs. Crawley in the ring of Hyde Park with a profound salute of the hat. She and her husband were invited immediately to one of the prince's small parties at Levant House, then occupied by His Highness during the temporary absence from England of its noble proprietor. She sang after dinner to a very little comite. The Marquis of Stang was present, paternally superintending the progress of his pupil. At Levant House Becky met one of the finest gentlemen and greatest ministers that Europe has produced, the Duc de la Jabotiere, then ambassador from the most Christian king, and subsequently minister to that monarch. I declare I swell with pride as these august names are transcribed by my pen, and I think in what brilliant company my dear Becky is moving. She became a constant guest at the French embassy, where no party was considered to be complete without the presence of the charming Madame Ravden Cravely, Messieurs de Trefigny of the Perigord family, and Champignac, both attaches of the embassy, were straightway smitten by the charms of the fair colonel's wife, and both declared, according to the wont of their nation, for whoever yet met a Frenchman, come out of England, that has not left half a dozen families miserable, and brought away as many hearts in his pocketbook? Comma both, I say, declared that they were au mieux with the charming Madame Ravden. But I doubt the correctness of the assertion. Champignac was very fond of Eckert, and made many parties with the colonel of evenings, while Becky was singing to Lord Stang in the other room, and as for Trefigny, it is a well-known fact that he dared not go to the Travellers, where he owed money to the waiters, and if he had not had the embassy as a dining place, the worthy young gentleman must have starved. I doubt, I say, that Becky would have selected either of these young men as a person on whom she would bestow her special regard. They ran of her messages, purchased her gloves and flowers, went in debt for opera boxes for her, and made themselves amiable in a thousand ways. And they talked English with adorable simplicity, unto the constant amusement of Becky and my Lord Stang. She would mimic one or other to his face, and compliment him on his advance in the English language with a gravity which never failed to tickle the Marquis, her sardonic old patron. Trefigny gave Briggs a shawl by way of winning over Becky's confidant, and asked her to take charge of a letter which the simple spinster handed over in public to the person to whom it was addressed, and the composition of which amused everybody who read it greatly. Lord Stang read it, everybody but honest Rawdon, to whom it was not necessary to tell everything that passed in the little house in Mayfair. Here, before long, Becky received not only the best foreigners, as the phrase is in our noble and admirable society slang, but some of the best English people too. I don't mean the most virtuous, or indeed the least virtuous, or the cleverest, or the stupidest, or the richest, or the best born, but the best, in a word, people about whom there is no question, such as the great Lady Fitzwillis, that patron saint of Almack's, the great Lady Slober, the great Lady Grizzle Macbeth, she was Lady G. Glory, daughter of Lord Grey of Glory, and the like. When the Countess of Fitzwillis, her ladyship is of the King Street family, see Deborah and Burke, takes up a person, he or she is safe. There is no question about them anymore. Not that my Lady Fitzwillis is any better than anybody else, being, on the contrary, a faded person, 57 years of age, and neither handsome, nor wealthy, nor entertaining, but it is agreed on all sides that she is of the best people. Those who go to her are of the best. And from an old grudge probably to Lady Stang, for whose coronet her ladyship, then the youthful Georgina Frederica, daughter of the Prince of Wales' favorite, the Earl of Portanchery, had once tried, this great and famous leader of the fashion, chose to acknowledge Mrs. Rawdon Crawley, made her a most marked curtsy at the assembly over which she presided, and not only encouraged her son, St. Kitts, his lordship got his place through Lord Stang's interest, to frequent Mrs. Crawley's house, but asked her to her own mansion, and spoke to her twice in the most public and condescending manner during dinner. The important fact was known all over London that night. People who had been crying fie about Mrs. Crawley were silent. Wenham, the wit and lawyer, Lord Stang's right-hand man, went about everywhere praising her. Some who had hesitated, came forward at once and welcomed her. Little Tom Toady, who had warned Southdown about visiting such an abandoned woman, now besought to be introduced to her. In a word, she was admitted to be among the best people. Ah, my beloved readers and brethren, do not envy poor Becky prematurely. Glory like this is said to be fugitive. It is currently reported that even in the very inmost circles, they are no happier than the poor wanderers outside the zone. And Becky, who penetrated into the very center of fashion, and saw the great George IV, face to face, has owned since that thereto was vanity. We must be brief in descanting upon this part of her career, as I cannot describe the mysteries of Freemasonry, although I have a shrewd idea that it is a humbug, so an uninitiated man cannot take upon himself to portray the great world accurately, and at best keep his opinions to himself, whatever they are. Becky has often spoken in subsequent years of this season of her life, when she moved among the very greatest circles of the London fashion. Her success excited, elated, and then bored her. At first no occupation was more pleasant than to invent and procure the latter a work of no small trouble and ingenuity, by the way, in the person of Mrs. Rawdon Crawley's very narrow means, to procure, we say, the prettiest new dresses and ornaments, to drive to fine dinner parties, where she was welcomed by great people, and from the fine dinner parties to fine assemblies, whither the same people came with whom as he had been dining, whom as he had met the night before, and would see on the morrow the young men faultlessly appointed, handsomely cravatted, with the neatest glossy boots and white gloves, the elders portly, brass-buttoned, noble-looking, polite, and prosy, the young ladies blonde, timid, and in pink, the mothers grand, beautiful, sumptuous, solemn, and in diamonds. They talked in English, not in bad French, as they do in the novels. They talked about each other's houses, and characters, and families just as the Geneses do about the Smiths. Becky's former acquaintances hated and envied her. The poor woman herself was yawning in spirit. "I wish I were out of it," she said to herself. "Would rather be a parson's wife, and teach a Sunday school than this, or a sergeant's lady, and ride in the regimental wagon, or, oh, how much gayer it would be, to wear spangles and trousers and dance before a booth at a fair." "You would do it very well," said Lord Steyne, laughing. She used to tell the great man her ennuis and perplexities in her artless way. They amused him. "Rawdon would make a very good equire master of the ceremonies. What do you call him, the man in the large boots and the uniform, who goes round the ring cracking the whip? He is large, heavy, and of a military figure. I recollect," Becky continued pensively, "my father took me to see a show at Brook Green Fair when I was a child, and when we came home, I made myself a pair of stilts and danced in the studio to the wonder of all the pupils." "I should have liked to see it," said Lord Steyne. "I should like to do it now," Becky continued. "Ow," Lady Blinky would open her eyes, and Lady Grizzle Macbeth would stare. "Hush! Silence! There is Pasta beginning to sing." Becky always made a point of being conspicuously polite to the professional ladies and gentlemen who attended at these aristocratic parties, of following them into the corners, where they sat in silence, and shaking hands with them, and smiling in the view of all persons. She was an artist herself, as she said very truly. There was a frankness and humility in the manner in which she acknowledged her origin, which provoked, or disarmed, or amused lookers-on, as the case might be. "How cool that woman is," said one. "What airs of independence she assumes, where she ought to sit still, and be thankful, if anybody speaks to her. W, what an honest, and good-natured soul she is," said another. "W, what an artful little minx," said a third. They were all right very likely, but Becky went her own way, and so fascinated the professional personages, that they would leave off their sore throats in order to sing at her parties, and give her lessons for nothing. Yes, she gave parties in the little house in Curzon Street. Many scores of carriages, with blazing lamps, blocked up the street, to the disgust of number 100, who could not rest for the thunder of the knocking, and of 102, who could not sleep for envy. The gigantic footmen who accompanied the vehicles were too big to be contained in Becky's little hall, and were billeted off in the neighboring public houses, whence, when they were wanted, call boys summoned them from their beer. Scores of the great dandies of London squeezed and trod on each other on the little stairs, laughing to find themselves there, and many spotless and severe ladies of ton were seated in the little drawing room, listening to the professional singers, who were singing according to their wont, and as if they wished to blow the windows down. And the day after, there appeared among the fashionable reunions, in the Morning Post a paragraph to the following effect. Yesterday, Colonel and Mrs. Crawley entertained a select party at dinner at their house in Mayfair. Their Excellencies the Prince and Princess of Pederweredon, H.E. Papush Pasha, the Turkish Ambassador attended by Kibab Bey, Dragoman of the Mission, the Marquess of Stang, Earl of Southdown, Sir Pitt and Lady Jane Crawley, Mr. Wag, and see after dinner Mrs. Crawley at an assembly which was attended by the Duchess Dowager of Stilton, Duc de la Grier, Marchioness of Cheshire, Marchese Alessandro Stracino, Comte de Bry, Baron Schapzuger, Chevalier Tosti, Countess of Slingstone, and Lady F. Macadam, Major General and Lady G. Macbeth, and two Miss Macbeths, Viscount Paddington, Sir Horace Fogey, Han, Sans Bedwin, Babachi Bahadur, and Anansi, which the reader may fill at his pleasure through a dozen close lines of small type. And in her commerce with the great our dear friend showed the same frankness which distinguished her transactions with the lowly in station. On one occasion, when out at a very fine house, Rebecca was, perhaps rather ostentatiously, holding a conversation in the French language with a celebrated tenor singer of that nation, while the Lady Grizzle Macbeth looked over her shoulder scowling at the pair. "How very well you speak French," Lady Grizzle said, who herself spoke the tongue in an Edinburgh accent most remarkable to hear. "I ought to know it," Becky modestly said, casting down her eyes. "I taught it in a school, and my mother was a Frenchwoman." Lady Grizzle was won by her humility, and was mollified towards the little woman. She deplored the fatal leveling tendencies of the age, which admitted persons of all classes into the society of their superiors, but her ladyship owned that this one at least was well behaved, and never forgot her place in life. She was a very good woman. Good to the poor, stupid, blameless, unsuspicious. It is not her ladyship's fault that she fancies herself better than you and me. The skirts of her ancestors' garments have been kissed for centuries. It is a thousand years, they say, since the tartans of the head of the family were embraced by the defunct Duncan's lords and counselors, when the great ancestor of the house became King of Scotland. Lady Stang, after the music scene, succumbed before Becky, and perhaps was not disinclined to her. The younger ladies of the House of Gaunt were also compelled into submission. Once or twice they set people at her, but they failed. The brilliant Lady Stunnington tried a passage of arms with her, but was routed with great slaughter by the intrepid little Becky. When attacked sometimes, Becky had a knack of adopting a demure ingenue, under which she was most dangerous. She said the wickedest things with the most simple and affected air when in this mood, and would take care artlessly to apologize for her blunders, so that all the world should know that as he had made them. Mr. Wag, the celebrated wit, and a lead captain and trencher man of my Lord Stang, was caused by the ladies to charge her, and the worthy fellow, leering at his patronesses and giving them a wink, as much as to say, "Now look out for sport," one evening began an assault upon Becky, who was unsuspiciously eating her dinner. The little woman, attacked on a sudden, but never without arms, lighted up in an instant, parried and riposted with a home thrust, which made Wag's face tingle with shame. Then she returned to her soup with the most perfect calm, and a quiet smile on her face. Wag's great patron, who gave him dinners, and lent him a little money sometimes, and whose election, newspaper, and other jobs Wag did, gave the luckless fellow such a savage glance with the eyes as almost made him sink under the table and burst into tears. He looked piteously at my lord, who never spoke to him during dinner, and at the ladies, who disowned him. At last Becky herself took compassion upon him, and tried to engage him in talk. He was not asked to dinner again for 6 weeks, and Fish, my lord's confidential man, to whom Wag naturally paid a good deal of court, was instructed to tell him that, if he ever dared to say a rude thing. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.